The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to Author Spotlight. Our guest is John McComber. He is co-author, along with Dr. Joseph Allen, of the new book, Healthy Buildings, subtitled How Indoor Spaces Drive Performance and Productivity, a book that was completed fortuitously just before the COVID-19 virus struck. John McComber is also a senior lecturer in the finance unit at Harvard Business School, and his professional background includes 30 years or more in the real estate and construction business. And we're going to take a little time here to talk about Healthy Buildings, talk about the book and what his research has turned up. Again, his research along with his co-author, Dr. Joseph Allen. John McComber, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You were actually working on this book before COVID ever struck. Is that correct? So it was just serendipity that you came out with a book called Healthy Buildings, right when everybody's kind of obsessed with that whole idea.
Well, the book was totally wrapped up by Joe Allen and me in the fall, long before COVID-19 happened. But everybody in public health is always thinking about pathogens and pandemics anyway, so it isn't that remarkable. From a sort of book launch point of view, the book launched April 22nd, right in the middle of COVID. So from a marketing point of view, I guess that's good. From a society point of view, it's terrible because we have this horrible scourge upon the planet. But it is nice for Joe and me. You know, we're both teachers and we think we can help. So the work has been able to be helpful to a lot of organizations as they think about how to get people back to work or back to school.
So what was the motivation to begin with? We didn't have a pandemic going at the time, but I should say that you were in the construction business. You've got a real estate background. You understand buildings and those environments. So what was your motivation?
I was at a dinner at the Harvard University Center for the Environment, and Joe Allen presented some of his research. And there were three things that really caught my eye. One is why are we ignoring the 90%? So what do you mean the 90%? Well, because most Americans and Europeans spend 90% of their time indoors, and it can be more for work for office class people in other places. So if you do the math on that about your indoor age, which we don't usually do in presentations because it involves public math and also people revealing how old they are, but I'm 64, so my indoor age is about 56. I spent 56 years of my life in homes, offices, schools, things like that. So there's a lot of discussion about air quality and outdoor air. Nobody thinks about indoor air. The second aspect is that we're all familiar with concepts of sick building, about bad carpets or Legionnaire's disease or something like that. But there's more to a healthy building than just not being a sick building. So the thing that really swayed me was research that Joe and his team did called the COG-FX study, or Function of Cognition, that was double-blind experiments using volunteers to do their regular office work in a specially set-up environment where the researchers changed three aspects of the air they were breathing. One was the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, second was particulates, and third was VOCs, or volatile organic compounds. And the workers would every day at the beginning, middle, and end, take some tests about just sort of problem solving and things like that. And what the research showed, really undeniably, was a real correlation between cognitive ability and air quality. So if you had a sort of normal building, people might perform at their baseline. If it was dirtier than usual, like with more carbon dioxide, they clearly did worse on some memory things and strategy things. If it was extra clean, they did better. So that started us thinking about, golly, this is something that's really being missed. And for me, as a real estate guy, I was thinking, why are we out there saving pennies on electricity and fans when there's tens of thousands of dollars being lost in people's productivity and performance? So The public health people have been talking about this for quite a while, but not necessarily having much traction with hospitals and schools and real estate people. And I thought, why don't I put the financial wrapper around this and think about how the supply chain works and how some of this information can propagate through the industry.
So when you talk about indoor air quality, is this, what's the issue here? Is it that the filtration systems, the HVAC systems are not up to grade? Is it that, you know, outdoor air pollution gets actually trapped in the building and amplified? Can kind of characterize what the issue is within buildings and the air quality. Who are the culprits here?
Sure. So in the United States, we assume that the outdoor air is cleaner than the indoor air. And so most codes talk about a certain amount of air changes per hour or filtration. Those are basically minimums, and they were established a long time ago. And our premise essentially is that acceptable air quality as defined by ASHRAE or others is not really acceptable. And in particular, if you look at air changes per hour, you wind up with these really sleepy rooms, like we've all been sleepy in conference rooms or in stuffy lecture halls, essentially because people are making the minimum. We think there should be a human performance-based minimum, not a specifier-based minimum. So the culprit largely is around the air filtration, or in a moment I can talk to you about the multiple foundations of a healthy building, but the one that's the most overlooked and has the easiest benefit-cost ratio to solve is around the quantity of air and the quality of the air.
So what happens? It sounds like people are kind of at low-grade asphyxiation. We are inhaling air that's bad. It's to some degree maybe suffocating the brain cells a little bit like alcohol does. It makes us sleepy. It makes us lethargic. I'm putting words in your mouth at this point. So you tell me, John, what did the test show in terms of the effects on people in a building and in an unhealthy building?
Well, there's two sort of components to that. The volatile organic compounds or the particulates act in a longer way. They can give you lung cancer or they can give you other diseases. The CO2 does impair your thinking. So we found that there was about a one standard deviation of difference in performance on these tests, which is significant, in an environment with as much as we could test people on, which is 1,500 parts per million of CO2. You actually have quite a bit more than that in a lot of environments that all of us find ourselves in, but that was what we thought we could comfortably do. And so that made us think, boy, it's not that the healthy building is just about keeping people from having the sniffles or missing a couple sick outs. We're really losing the potential for people to be more productive. Of course, productivity depends on motivation and skills and other things like that. But we thought that the equation wasn't really right. There were people thinking about saving energy and having these extremely airtight buildings. Like, the ventilation wasn't an issue 30 years ago when the buildings all leak like crazy. Then they got really tight because people were chasing energy. But if you think about a knowledge worker kind of company, like a law firm or a consulting firm, their income statement consists of about 50% payroll, about 30% rent, and about 5% energy in their space. So here we are chasing 10% of 5%. That doesn't move the needle at all. But if you think about the 50% of payroll, if you can keep people from being sick a couple days less or keep people from wanting to change employers, that saves costs. But the holy grail is the top line, the revenue line. If you think about having people on a commission basis make those two extra calls or on a creative basis do that one extra advertisement or something like that, then you're talking about a little change in the top line goes straight to the bottom line. So we thought it was short-sighted that somebody controlling the energy is getting congratulations for slowing the fans down and stretching the filters longer, and nobody was thinking about the performance of the people.
People in the development business, when they think in terms of creating a healthy building, there's of course a cost involved in that. Now there's the whole cost benefit analysis that goes on. You're in the business, so you can speak with authority on this, but before we even get to that, talk about I think you said the foundations of a healthy building. What are those? If you're going to build an edifice that's truly healthy, what has to happen? What needs to be there?
So the report that we've done around the 9 foundations of a healthy building is based on about 40 years of public health research. And part of my role was to translate that public health research into my world, which I spent 30 years in real estate and construction. So the 9 foundations are pretty intuitive. Ventilation, air quality, thermal health, moisture, dust and pests, safety and security, water quality, noise, and lighting and views. And some of these are pretty obvious, like most buildings in the United States have reasonable water quality and most buildings don't leak. Most buildings that are going to lease to premium tenants have views or have good windows or something like that. As I mentioned before, that what we thought had the biggest gap was in the air, because you can't see the air. You can't really sense the ventilation, and until recently you couldn't measure it, whereas some of the other things like noise or moisture are much more obvious. And some of the things that people used to measure in the air were easy, like temperature and humidity. It was hard until a few years ago to even measure CO2 in the air. And that was the realm of an industrial hygienist. They'd come in with their machine, they'd take a measurement and disappear for a week and come back and give the information to the big boss, and it might not get circulated. Now it's possible to go to Best Buy or Home Depot and get, for $100, get an indoor air quality monitor that can tell you right in front of your face what the carbon dioxide level is, what the VOCs are, what the particulates are. So it's a time when people have much more awareness of the ventilation pieces.
That's amazing. So let me ask you about moisture. Do most buildings have too much moisture and it promotes the growth of mold, or are many of them too dry and it creates dehydration in the occupants?
Well, there's two aspects to it. One is around the physical damage. So when I was a contractor, the biggest callback issues we'd have would be the roof leaks or the ductwork has condensation or the basement leaks or something like that. That kind of moisture leads to mold or just to structural damage, particularly in a wood building. The second is indeed around humidification. And it turns out with COVID that COVID likes it dry. So having a building properly humidified slows down some of the transmission of COVID. Also, buildings are humidified and dehumidified all year long. So if you have an air-conditioned building, you have to bring in outdoor air, dry it out, and then rehumidify it to put back in the space. So there's lots of things where that is missed. And there are elements of comfort that we can just feel. And you see these psychrometric charts that are put out by ventilation firms saying that generally people are comfortable in the United States around 70, 72 degrees, around 50 or 60% relative humidity. But if either of those varies, then we're just out of that physical comfort zone without even thinking about the CO2 and the particulates and the other components. So both those aspects of moisture have to be addressed, both what affects the actual building and the thing that affects the people.
So let's talk about the cost-benefit analysis. You know, our magazines, we publish seven different titles, and the people we write about and the people who actually support our organization are invested in the trillions of dollars in real estate around the world. And they've been remarkably responsive to a lot of different changes that have been going on, things having to do with carbon emissions and natural lighting and so on. And you're getting into an area here where, it all has to make sense financially. You've spent 30 plus years in the business. You understand this. If there's a builder saying, does this really work out for me financially? What's your response to that?
Well, let's talk about pre-COVID and post-COVID, and let's talk about pre-recession and post-recession.
Okay.
So pre-COVID, when Joe and I wrote the book, the argument was that the healthy buildings mattered particularly to knowledge worker type firms, and then you can extend that also to where you live because you spend 8 or 12 hours a day in your home, and that just the impact on the potential to be more productive and less sick justified it. So we wrote a case study about a new building in New York, 425 Park Avenue, developed by L&L Properties and designed by Norman Foster, the well-known Lord Norman Foster, the well-known British architect. And their objective was to have it be the first building that was certified by WELL, which is a building certifying group, And they argued that it'd be the healthiest building in New York, maybe the healthiest building in the world. So I was interested in what is the rationale here. So we went to look at what are the increased capital costs. And generally, between the capital costs to construct the building and some operating costs on the landlord side, it might have been 1 or 2%. Then what does the difference have to be in rent? So the case study I wrote for my students is how much more rent does the operator have to get in order to make this worthwhile? And the answer also is about 1 or 2%, which is relatively de minimis. Of course, when you create a value like a healthier building, then you have this negotiation about who captures the value, because if there's no increase in rent, then the value is basically captured by the employees because they're healthier. Or maybe the landlord and the tenant negotiate that trade-off. So then the conversation became one around marketing. And in an upmarket, it was felt that this is another aspect of competitive building that the most demanding tenants will want. Now, we're talking about an elite building in an elite location with elite tenants. But in upmarket, the developers felt that they would be able to get a premium for the space. And in a sense, you're kind of arguing about, is this like another amenity? Is it like having an extra gym or an extra daycare or a community space or a cafeteria or something like that? Or is it a must-have? What they are finding in the downturn is that maybe they're not getting a premium, but all else equal, the tenants are coming to them. So now you think recession. We're obviously going to be in a big real estate recession, notably in retail and in hotels and probably in apartments and offices going forward. In a downturn, the people who can actually pay their mortgage or pay their rent will be in the driver's seat and be able to demand what they want. And post-COVID, they are certainly looking for healthy buildings. So now it looks like the developer I was mentioning had inoculated themselves, in a sense, against this downturn and this pandemic by having a building that was demonstrably healthy. So the argument becomes, in an upmarket, you get a premium. In a downmarket, you get the tenant. The question that I ask my students and the question that's unknown is, how many tenants will actually believe that? Are there only, you know, a million square feet worth of office tenants in New York who believe they'll pay extra for a healthy building? Or is this going to propagate through the industry over the course of time as people learn about it? And that's the big unknown, and that's what we'll find out in the market going forward. Now, post-COVID time, the healthy aspect is so crucial because the downside of a sick building is so much deeper down than we thought it was a year ago. Before it was, yeah, I mean, people are sleeping, a couple of people have colds. Well, now it's really expensive to have an employee on a ventilator for 2 weeks. So that equation changes. Similarly, the liability equation changes. I'm not sure you want to go into that, but nobody knows what's going to happen with all these various exposures and business interruptions, and is there going to be force majeure relief or force majeure compensation, or how do I even know if I want to invest in this building going forward that might or might not be insurable around COVID? All that is up in the air.
Well, how does a person make a building COVID safe? Or for that matter, it's not just COVID. I mean, going forward, we're going to have other pathogens. We're going to have other viruses that are going to come along. I mean, the last, 20 years, we've seen about four of them already. Luckily, only one of them has broken out big. What about that? What kind of technologies are available? Do you see new technologies coming to market that are going to be able to make office buildings and retail centers and housing for that, multifamily housing and so on, safe against pandemics?
Yes, and there are two kinds of technologies. One is in the physical building, like different kinds of lighting or different kinds of furniture, and the second is around monitoring behavior. So I'll give you a two-part answer to that. One is with a hierarchy of controls. So if you think about a picture of a hierarchy, like a hierarchy of needs or housing pyramid, at the bottom, the most effective way to minimize the transmission of a virus like COVID-19 is for people to stay home, to socially distance. Unfortunately, that's also super expensive. If you move up the hierarchy, the next layer up, a narrower band on the triangle is selective people coming to work, meaning essential workers, whether it's in your stockbroker firm or bus drivers and food workers. And that's not as effective, but it's not as expensive to the company or society. The next layer up, the middle layer in this five-stripe pyramid, is around engineering controls. And I'll come back to those in a moment. But those are things like more ventilation, better filtration, ultraviolet radiation in the ultraviolet light in the ductwork, things like that. The next layer up is a little less expensive, but a lot more, a little less effective, but a lot more expensive, is administrative controls. Administrative controls are things like the 6-foot distancing, 4 people in the elevator, not having a salad bar, staggering the workforce so people come in on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, something like that. And the top of the pyramid, the skinniest little triangle, is personal protective equipment, which is actually the least effective compared to social distancing, but it's also the cheapest. So there has to be a blend. There's no one-size-fits-all, and there's no way to eliminate all risk. So every building owner and essentially everybody going to building has to see where they fit in that mix. So within that band of technologies, I mentioned a couple of them. There are also bacteria and virus-resistant surfaces that people are talking about, and there's plenty of people trying to sell all kinds of new stuff for buildings. There's lots of advances made by the furniture companies about how you can be farther apart or have plexiglass shields or something like that. Now, with that said, we think that also needs to be measured because we wrote an article for Forbes called "Who Guarantees Your Workplace is Safe for Return?" And the short answer is nobody guarantees it. There's not somebody from the government or a health administration or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or the landlord or the insurance company guaranteeing this, but there are things you can measure. There are safe harbors regardless of whether you're the landlord, the tenant, the office worker, somebody in a college, somebody in a school. Of course, Joe and I talk a lot with school administrators about opening up. And those are five things which have alliterative way to remember them around settings, sensors, screening, surveys, and statistics. So this is all looking at, are the physical things working in the building and are the people doing what they're supposed to do? So think about settings. It's possible, say, for a landlord who's trying to promote how healthy their building is or for a hotel chain or for an airline to say, we have this set so there's 10 air changes an hour, not 3. We have it set so we're using a MERV 13 filter, not a MERV 8, so that takes up more particulates. We have it set so the humidity is at 60, not 50, and we think it's going to deter the spread of the virus. All those things are settings that can be publicized if somebody has a competitive building. Similarly, there are screenings, and the most obvious one is now you see all these pictures of thermal screening, like do you have a fever, which isn't actually a very good proxy for do you have COVID. The swab test or the blood antibody test is a better test, and that's what they do in the White House every day. But students going back to MIT, for instance, will have to be tested when they come back and every couple of weeks and screened for whether they can be in the buildings. The next is around sensors, and one kind of sensor is a thermal sensor, but a blood oximeter is another kind of sensor that people use. People wear Fitbits and Apple Watches to see what their pulse rate is and what their respiration rate is, which can be an early warning. And people can have their own individual air quality monitors. So if you're going to work in the meatpacking plant and you find out that there's high level of carbon dioxide, high level of volatile organic compounds, high level of particulates, there's probably a good chance that a virus can spread more easily than somewhere else. The third around surveys will also be done with every student going back to Harvard or MIT this year. Every day, they'll have to answer an app and say, so how do you feel? What are your symptoms? A second aspect of surveys is how are your colleagues behaving? So if you're in an office space and you have a colleague who doesn't wear a mask and they sit 2 feet away and sneeze on you constantly, you'd like to be able to mention that to somebody because it's not following the protocols. And the last, of course, is statistics, like does it work? And even before COVID, Joe and I were talking about this a lot in terms of health performance indicators because ultimately we don't care if the building is healthy. We want the human beings to be healthy. So you measure sick days, you measure output, you measure healthcare costs, and nowadays healthcare costs is actually quite a good proxy, a lagging indicator for how healthy your building is because if your people are healthy, your healthcare costs are a lot lower. So a very long answer to a short question, but that's how you, those are the kind of things you do around the hierarchy of controls and the five aspects of setting, sensors, survey, statistics, and screening that help people think about whether it's safe to come back. And if I'm a competitive landlord, I'm measuring those things and I'm posting them right there on the door saying, here's what we're doing. We're making a best effort. We can't eliminate all risk, but here's what we're doing.
So just as you walk into a restaurant, and a restaurant will talk about what its rating is, it's possible we could walk into an office building someday and its health rating is posted right there, maybe even required. I mean, is that realistic? Or obviously, you've already indicated that a landlord can say, you know, we do very well on these measures, but is it realistic that we would have a health code for office buildings that is actually posted?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question of who gets to maintain that rating system. Because if you think, say, in the hotel business, yeah, the hotels are maybe 4 or 5 stars or something like that, but whose rating actually matters? The guests and the people on TripAdvisor and Kayak and Travelocity, they're filling out these ratings. Well, now, if you imagine a scenario where these hotel guests and the airplane passengers and the office workers and the apartment renters are using their own individual air quality monitors to put out into the cloud somewhere what the conditions are of those things they can measure in the building, and then some third party develops that rating system, that could be as influential as TripAdvisor, or 20 years ago as influential as Morningstar and Lipper in the mutual fund space, rating these things out of the control of the landlord. So there might be that kind of democratization of sensors. So maybe there'll be some kind of centralized rating. Maybe a big landlord, you know, an equity officer or a relator of Renato or somebody will be able to do their own system. Or maybe the individuals will take it upon themselves. We don't know. We don't know what will happen at all. But there are a couple things that are for sure. And one is that the public's awareness of public health issues is not going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just know smartphone manufacturers are looking for a way to put sensors in the phone that's going to measure air quality and so on. I mean, we have so much technology packed into phones these days that it wouldn't be. I don't know how realistic it is at this time, but all of these costs seem to go down and go down. But speaking of that, well, let's say you have a Class C or Class B building, and you want to make it, you retrofit it to make it healthy. Is that done at a reasonable cost? Is that doable, or is it does it not really work out financially? Because look, you're already Class C or B building, and unless you're going to upgrade to Class A, pretty much forget about it.
Well, you're only going to do it if you think the tenants are going to care, and that's sort of a function of how many tenants there are going to be. So I'm a little pessimistic about the U.S. economy for the next several quarters at least. So maybe there are a lot of buildings that won't quite open up, and we've all been on plenty of conference calls. You've probably done podcasts with people who were invested in hotels that are never going to open again, or restaurants or retail spaces that are never going to open again. So it kind of depends what the tenants are interested in. If you have tenants who are thinking about this, it's relatively straightforward for a landlord to use the base building system to just run the fans more, have the set points different, change the filters more. And if you go in the MERV rating of filtration, generally you can drop that in. If you go to a higher level, the HEPA filters, the high energy particulate filters like they have in airplanes and hospital rooms, that's a lot harder because you're going to crush your old ducts. So you can't, it's really expensive to change that. So the question of changing to that HEPA level, airplane hospital level, would really be only something that you would do if you're already down to a core and shell sort of gut renovation anyway. So the first several things on the nine foundations around the basic filtration, air quality, noise safety, and things like that are relatively inexpensive. But when you go to the next level up, it's more expensive. That's part of why Joe and I advocate thinking about these administrative controls and also seeing that the people are indeed careful about the subway they ride in or the bus they ride in, or they're wearing masks if that's the rule, or they're 6 feet apart if that's the rule. And there'll be a question about how much can a landlord or a hotel owner or a restaurant owner or somebody running a retail store influence that. And you see things in the paper all the time about shoppers going to stores and being mad about being asked to follow those rules also. But like a lot of things, the cheapest thing to influence is not the bricks and sticks and technology. The cheapest thing to influence is human behavior. It's just hard to influence human behavior.
It'd
be a combination, I think, of capital investment, and capital investment either by landlord or by tenant. You're only going to do it if you think the tenant cares, and the tenant ought to be thinking about these other aspects in their business and the things they can look at around the administrative controls before anybody goes out, rips out the ductwork, puts in HEPA filters and ultraviolet lights everywhere.
So for every 100 buildings in the United States, how many are healthy?
Well, if you ask it in terms of how many are certified by some of these new groups like the U.S. Green Building Council or the WELL Building Institute or Fitwell, the answer is a couple hundred. So the idea of certifying a healthy building is quite new. And part of the reason that Joe and I initially wrote the book is that we thought that some of the early healthy building certification systems were flawed in that they were sort of point systems, not results-based systems, and they were at a single point in time. They weren't continuously commissioned. So we're trying to argue that if people are going to be thinking about healthy buildings, they ought to be looking at something you can objectively measure, something where you get time series data and something where it's looked at over and over and over again. So I think the WELL Building Institute maybe has a couple thousand certified buildings now, so the answer is very few in that certified kind of space. It's similar to where green buildings were 15 or 20 years ago. People hadn't really thought about it yet. Although it could be.
But a lot of pressure, I mean, wouldn't you agree, John, a lot of pressure is going to be brought to bear now because people are so conscious of getting walking into a building and knowing that they're safe. And as you say, it's behavior that drives most of that. But at the same time, it's just what's in the air? You know, how are we doing here? So I would imagine that this is something that could move pretty quickly.
I agree with you, because the green buildings are kind of an abstraction. Saving the energy or not using rainforest wood isn't something that you really see. It's actually quite impressive what the U.S. Green Building Council did in promoting the LEED standard, because they didn't have any standing. You know, they weren't a standards writing board. They weren't a building code authority, but they got people to pay attention to this. Our view is that the avoided cost of bad health is much higher than the avoided cost of energy or the avoided cost of some aspects of a green building. So therefore, the investment case is going to be a lot clearer. And if you think about, say, people doing investment in energy efficiency, yeah, that was kind of a borderline thing to do. It was nice to do. But if you imagine third parties coming out and saying, I'll come in and I'll help finance you making your building healthier, and you're going to pay me back with a combination of your health insurance savings and the added rent that you get, that's a much more compelling story, particularly if you think about these health insurance costs. So we've been talking with several entities who are large employers who self-insure on health insurance, and now you're talking about the same pocket of cash. It's just that you don't usually have the building facilities guy talking to the health insurance guy or lady. And so when they're thinking, maybe we can keep these students or these occupants or these patients from spending so much in healthcare on the COVID side, it's a lot easier to justify the investment, the CapEx in a healthy building up front than when you had the abstraction of energy savings or when the health issue was not so prominent. So, you know, among the issues, one of the questions that we don't know are ever going to go back in the bottle, one is the work from away question, because the technologies have probably advanced 30 years of people's comfort in Zoom and Slack and Teams and those kind of things. And the second is, people probably won't forget this public health crisis. It'll be top of mind for a long time. And as you said before, there'll be another one. And so we have to be thinking about that. So I think that's going to change that equation. It also means that, like a lot of things, if you have capital and information, you do better. So if you're a big REIT and you don't have a lot of debt and you have four people on your staff who can think about the cost benefit for all these things to put together, then you can do it a lot faster. Then you're for mom and pop and you have 30,000 square feet in the suburbs with three law firms and two dentists, and the dentists haven't paid their rent in 3 months, and you don't have anybody on your staff to go out and figure this stuff out, that's a lot harder. So it becomes a winner-take-all kind of thing. It's really scary from the point of view of a small holder or a small investor.
Well, I would think that one of the first places that would think hard about this and maybe even be one of the first movers is the senior housing sector, because the percentage of deaths from COVID in nursing homes has been really high. I think the figure I heard in Boston, although I cannot verify it, is 90% of the deaths were in nursing homes in that city, which is remarkable. What are the biggest impediments then to moving from a traditional building to a healthy building? Are there very many impediments, or is it just really kind of an effect of people the people who construct and operate the buildings, it just hasn't been at the forefront of their consciousness.
I'll make a comment about the Boston stat. I live in Massachusetts. I don't know if it's 90%, but it's certainly more than 70 or 80% are over 75 or 80 years old. The population is only 2 or 3%, 70 or 80 years old. So statistically, that means that if you were over 80 on New Year's, there's a 3% chance that today you are dead. Not just infected, but dead, because it's been so disproportionate in the elderly population. And we've had some really horrible senior living situations, notably in VA hospitals and some others that were poorly staffed to begin with. So it's been a real tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to what makes a building healthy, let me give a pre-COVID and post-COVID answer. The pre-COVID answer is it's not that hard. And part of the reason we wrote the book is because we thought people were just leaving money on the ground by pinching pennies around energy when really they could do, you could have both. You can have a green and energy efficient building and a healthy building and people will do better. That's why I wrote the book, to try and persuade marginal investors to make this little change because it made sense in the pre-COVID world. Post-COVID, of course, it's a lot scarier. And if you think about senior living, then it would have to include both the physical aspects, but also the testing kind of aspects. So there's thought that a lot of the reason this is not yet validated or empirically shown, but a lot of the reason why the senior deaths were high in Massachusetts is because it was spread by health workers. And health workers often had to work in two or three facilities. They usually had to take public transportation. It wasn't yet known how contagious the virus was. And so there are a lot of aspects around how the individual workers are compensated and protected that are a little bit different than the aspects in the buildings. Maybe there's some multiple bed facilities or multiple bathroom facilities or something like that, but it's much more a question than that. I think it's going to emerge that the healthcare workers are not being paid enough, not being treated well enough, and not being protected well enough, and that will probably wind up being the intervention. And that's also really expensive. You know, it's expensive to pay somebody enough that they don't need to have three jobs and ride the public transportation and keep going to work even when they're sick. But that's another reason why the elder living is such a difficult real estate class, because you're not just providing a space to a tenant who's self-sufficient, you're supplying a service and a health service. Some people really want to be in that operating space and that sector of real estate, and others say, I'd really rather have a hotel even today where the people are going to leave. So also a long answer to a short question, but senior living is it's healthcare, it's not real estate. I mean, kind of people call it real estate, but the issues are much more around, in my view, are much more around the staffing than around the physical plant.
Yeah, it's definitely been problematic. I mean, that was really brought into full view with the outbreak with COVID, just the understaffed, overworked, and then not, I guess, largely they can't be faulted for not having the proper equipment because they weren't really prepared for something like this, like most places, but they certainly have learned a lesson. And, the whole healthy buildings thing certainly plays into that segment of the real estate business. Let me ask you this in closing, John, I already asked you about technologies that can be brought to bear, but if you were to give a vision of where healthy buildings could be, what a healthy building could look like in say 10 or 20 years, which is a long period of time given how quickly technology advances, do you have any foresight, and we're not going to hold you to it, but just knowing what you know, what do you think a healthy building could be equipped with in, say, 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think there's several sort of unknowns that go into that answer. One is, like, do we actually get a handle on COVID-19, or is it with us forever and something you can get again and something that stays tremendously contagious? The second is actually around the price of oil, believe it or not. Right now, oil's trading about $40. It's a relatively historic low in our recent memory. And when oil is cheap, it means renewables aren't as competitive. It also means it's inexpensive to drive. So if you imagine a scenario where we never handle COVID and oil stays cheap, that will reverse people is moving to cities, and people will find it easier to live somewhere where they can come into the headquarters once or twice a week and work remotely, because that has been figured out, at least for knowledge workers, not for factory workers and meatpacking workers and the people who have to drive the buses. So that would change the idea of a healthy building to one where people aren't in elevators and one where they can open the windows. If we get a handle on COVID and if oil prices go back up based on economic demand, it means the economies have done well and people are much more aware of the regular hygiene and sanitation. So there's a lot of things that could have been addressed early on with wash your hands more and be careful about how close you get to your uncle who's spits on you when he talks, and those kind of things. The other unknown is around outdoor air quality. So we assume in the United States that the outdoor air is cleaner than the indoor air. That's not true in a lot of places. Historically, it wasn't true in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is better now, but it's not true in Mexico or in Delhi or in Mumbai. And so you have a phenomenon where the landlord or the tenant themselves would be expected to clean the air better than the outside air. That's not what building codes are written to now. So you can imagine people competing to say, our outside air is filtered better, is brought in more often, and it's filtered better, and don't take our word for it. Use your own personal air monitor, which 20 years from now will be certainly be in your phone. So I think the democratization of the sensors will, and people's awareness of the public health concerns will make all of the occupants, whether they're office workers, meatpacking workers, subway drivers, apartment renters, or students, much more aware of which buildings are healthier. And then you get back to the nine foundations. They're going to be buildings that have both good ventilation and good filtration, have good control of humidity, have good control of moisture, and have light. So I think that there's a lot of manifestations in the market that will unfold in a way that where the actual structure looks like what we'd intuitively think it would look like. It's got fresh air and daylight and some of the other things. But it's much more economically required, because the users will be that much more informed and that much more demanding.
Our guest has been John McComber. He is co-author, along with Dr. Joseph Allen, of the book, the extremely fortuitously timed book, titled Healthy Buildings, How Indoor Spaces Drive Performance and Productivity. John, really interesting stuff, and your timing is impeccable. Thanks a lot for taking the time and walking us through your research.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.